There are many reasons why one cares about a city. Why you care about its problems, its people, and indeed its very future. Is it friendly, warm, hospitable? And are there good job opportunities, educational facilities, and a cultural center? Are you proud to call it your hometown? When you come right down to it, I'd venture to say you'll all agree to a resounding yes when you're talking about Detroit, my hometown.
Smokey Robinson and the Miracles with I Care About Detroit, a love anthem they sang to the city in 1967, released in glorious mono, as you heard, as a single that year. 2 years later, it will be the official anthem of I Care About Detroit Day, with Robinson himself as volunteer chairman. One of the most prolific songwriters in U.S. history, Robinson was singing and writing songs while at Dwyer Elementary School and Northern High School. His songwriting would catapult him and many pop icons from Berry Gordy's Motown recording empire into worldwide fame. His own success would make him a vice president of the historic company. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, September the 8th, and we're talking about Motown's Katrina, the secret bankruptcy plans for Detroit's public schools. A trial to determine whether the city of Detroit will be given official clearance under federal bankruptcy laws to proceed with its draconian restructuring plan is in its second week. It's the final phase of legal wrangling over whether Kevin Orr, the state-imposed emergency manager for the city, has first proven $18 billion in debt, has worked out agreements with creditors on how much and how they will be paid, and has a credible plan for putting the city back on solid long-term fiscal footing. Detroit's bankruptcy, as you know, is the largest for a municipality in U.S. history, and it has drawn national and international attention because Detroit was the world-renowned center for U.S. automobile manufacturing. Our guests on Lead Stories today will be discussing a major intended, I want to underscore that, intended consequence of Detroit's bankruptcy, and that is the evisceration of its public school system, and according to them, it's already in progress. Hurricane Katrina was used to shut down New Orleans public schools completely. In that city now, charter schools are fully in charge of education, and bankruptcy is being used to hasten the shutting down of Detroit's schools, they say. Joining us today are Elena Herrada, a member of the Detroit School Board and an activist with Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, and Dr. Thomas Pedroni, Associate Professor of Curriculum Studies and Policy Sociology at Wayne State University, and Director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project. And I want to welcome you both to the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to say to the listeners, because we've been covering Detroit since last year, the bankruptcy aspect of it, our conversation today is yet another chapter in the thesis we outlined since last year, and that is Detroit, in many ways, is setting the template for what will be happening in major cities across America with significant African-American and Latino populations that are systematically being emptied, being, quote, reclaimed, unquote, and re-engineered, unquote, for desirable people. Let's start with you, Elena. How do you read what is going on? We're not covering the trial today. We're talking about the consequences of the trial and the impact of the trial. How are you reading?
Well, there's something that I've read that I found very disturbing in the coverage of the trial in the Detroit Free Press, which is basically a mouthpiece for the Jones Day law firm, which is the law firm that is that both the debtor and creditor and replaces all of our government. The Jones Day law firm is running Detroit. And first of all, for the creditor and debtor to be the same party, some people would think that that's a conflict of interest, but it has been approved by the federal court. So basically, the thing that I wanted to talk about today that I think is very important and is not being given any kind of media attention is the fact that the judge, Judge Rhodes, does not know that Detroit schools are being sold as part of the bankruptcy swap settlements. And we were told that by the emergency manager of Detroit Public Schools, real estate mogul, who closed a very, very successful folk tech center called Davis Aerospace, the one that was really sponsored by the Tuskegee Airmen, and it's connected to Detroit City Airport, also known as Coleman Young International Airport. So we had heard that Jones Day wanted that airport, and it's on the east side of Detroit in a location that they've been pretty much clearing in some really brutal ways and closing down schools. And I'm going to talk about the other projects that they have going on there. But the city of Detroit is separate from the Detroit Public Schools, and we did not have mayoral control over the schools. It's a separate entity. So the budget is separate, and there has been an effort on the part of the philanthropic and nonprofit communities to merge the Detroit Public Schools under the mayor's office because they basically control the mayor's office. But the school board is separate, and we've been elected, and we have not capitulated to emergency management, and we do not get paid. So there isn't really much that they can do with us because we fight to defend public schools. But in the paper, the judge states to the lawyers, well, if it's necessary to sell off the schools to pay for some of the debts of the city, would you do that? And the lawyers respond to the judge, no, we wouldn't do that because that would have a negative impact on the residents, which is it certainly does have a negative impact, but it is happening, and the judge does not know that, and there isn't any communication to the judge that this is an asset that is on the table that's being sold that Jones Day is not divulging to the bankruptcy court. So they're basically taking our schools and selling them off and displacing our students. They were moved from one school to another in the middle of the year in a very successful Volk Tech school. Their curriculum taken from them. And the FCC has to, I think it's FCC that has to, is that the one that regulates flights?
FAA?
FAA. Yeah. They're the ones that regulate the curriculum for that school because the students were actually being trained as airplane mechanics and pilots, and they took away that certification now because they don't have the curriculum anymore. They sold that school off in the middle of the year with students in the classrooms and moved them to a Volk Tech that doesn't have any of that, and never even went to the board and told them that it was closing. They sold it off right out from under us, and the judge has no access to information like that. And that's what's very, very disconcerting. This would never happen in a white city. It would never happen. That's just one tip of the iceberg of what's happening in bankrupt Detroit.
Could you describe, as a member of the school board, the Detroit school board, what the state of affairs is in terms of schools that have been shuttered?
More than half of our schools have been closed. The schools that remain have charters inside of them. There's multiple schools in certain buildings. So there's two and three different types of schools in the same building. There's little children in with high schools where initially when they first took over the district, they were talking about this small schools project, that the schools were too big, and that education occurs in a much better and smaller school than smaller places, and there would be more small community schools. Within a year of that rhetoric, they started packing all of our students into one building of all ages, merging schools that had rival gangs attached to them, creating incredible violence in some of the areas. And those are some of the projects that are going on without any regard to the demographic, to the curriculum, to anything else. They're just jamming our students into these buildings. That's what's happening, while they also have seven superintendents, seven assistant superintendents, all of whom make over $100,000 a year. It's a free-for-all.
And when these students are herded, removed from one school and just herded into other schools, what happens to those buildings? What's going on with the buildings?
The buildings in many cases have been left to be vandalized and stripped. We'll talk about Oakman. I'm going to let Tom talk about Oakman Elementary School. Southwestern High School was a beautiful high school in Southwest Detroit that was left. We're going to be paying the bond money for that until 2039. There's a brand new roof, a brand new auditorium, brand new track field, and it's been emptied and gutted. And no students are obviously... Our students are being herded into an Educational Achievement Authority school instead of the beautiful high school that we had. So they're deliberately failing our students and putting them into a separate and unequal school district that is not under the control of Detroit Public Schools at all, but uses Detroit Public School money to fund it into private hands and also to fail our students. So these students won't have a chance of going to college when the EAA gets finished with them. And I'm also going to sort of defer to Tom on some of the EAA discussion.
Dr. Pedroni, you years ago had described the Katrina moment that Detroit would experience, and it is your contention that that moment is now. Could you describe what you meant by the Katrina moment for Detroit?
Certainly, yeah. And I wish I could claim authorship for that, but actually it's not only me and some of the community activists and people like Elena who have been comparing New Orleans and Detroit. Also the very powerful are doing that as well. So New Orleans has actually been heralded as an example by our larger foundations who funded an extensive series on our local public radio stations to point out the alleged great successes of the New Orleans model and how it could serve Detroit well. But I want to go back to 2009, which is when Arne Duncan famously stated to the nation...
Arne Duncan being the Secretary of Education.
Yes, thank you. Under President Obama, he stated to the nation, I think in a very prescient way for what we were about to experience, he said, the best thing that ever happened to the New Orleans public school system was Hurricane Katrina. And so I suppose the problem that we were faced with is that we didn't have hurricanes here to help us out like New Orleans had been helped out. But there are other ways of creating the same sort of objective. And what you basically have to do is create crisis conditions, as Naomi Klein has talked about extensively in her own work, you know, sort of the disaster capitalism model. If there's ever a poster child for the disaster of capitalism, I guess you could say it's Detroit, right? Where, notwithstanding the constant blaming of the most vulnerable people in the city for the crisis situations that we and they find themselves in. What really has caused Detroit historically, of course, I don't need to recite this at length because I'm sure your audience knows, is massive deindustrialization. Not that the industries weren't profitable, they were, but they went to pursue much greater profit in parts of the world or even parts of the country at first, where wages were lower, where the workforce had no union protection, and where environmental laws were practically non-existent. That's the formula for maximizing profit, which is, of course, what their job is. But we need to also think more recently. We did have something that was much more destructive than a hurricane in 2008 globally when we had the financial meltdown. And what people need to think about in relationship to that is that while that affected everyone, certainly initially, its experience has been much harsher for the most vulnerable in our society and certainly for people living in Detroit. I'm hearing some feedback as I speak, but I'm going to be confident that you're hearing me okay. So let me go on. Really what we need to see, the 2008 foreclosure crisis and the financial collapse that followed it, is as an eradication of the minimal black wealth that had accumulated in our cities. Detroit was well known as the center, at the top of the charts in terms of African-American homeownership in large cities. And so it did have, despite its long suffering, it did have some accumulation of African-American wealth. That has been almost totally wiped out now. So what you have is, I think the bankruptcy, I would look at it as maybe a next chapter or maybe a necessary step on the way to the ultimate vision. But I think we need to talk a little bit about what that vision was. So in 2009, when Secretary of Education Arne Duncan said that New Orleans' great blessing was Hurricane Katrina. He also came to Detroit and said that Detroit was ground zero for education. He said he lost sleep at night because of what was happening in Detroit schools at that time. Well, I feel really bad for the poor gentleman because he hasn't slept for over 5 years now if he was losing sleep over Detroit public schools then. Because what has happened is since what we call the takeover, well, I think everyone calls it a takeover of Detroit schools through the system of emergency management by Governor Snyder, which Arne Duncan supported and which also the local foundations that Elena spoke about supported as well, has been cataclysmic for the public schools. Perhaps most importantly on their favorite measure, not mine, but the favorite measure of the Arne Duncans and the foundations of the world is on test scores, on that sort of achievement. The students in Detroit have fallen much further behind since emergency management was posed in 2009 relative to their Michigan peers, the Michigan averages. They were already well behind. They've fallen much farther behind. And that has been the case in every grade, third grade through eighth grade in reading and third grade to fifth grade in math. I want to highlight that the students in third to fifth grade are the ones who have spent now most or their entire school lives under emergency management. And so, one thing we need to think about is that with that growing gap, especially at the younger grades, we're going to have the echoes of this for a long time in Detroit, even if we're able to throw off, the dictatorial management of our schools for such a long time. So here we are now after 5 years of emergency management. And one thing I want to do is kind of situate real quickly, and then I'll take a breath and let Elena and our host speak. I think what we need to point to is something called the Detroit Future City Plan, which grew out of an earlier plan proposed by Mayor Bing. And when we say proposed by Mayor Bing, it obviously, he was a basketball player, so we don't really expect that he came up with this large plan for the city. But really, it was proposed by a number of banking groups. Through a coalition called Living Cities. And they are, of course, many of the same players who are both involved in the bankruptcy and also are very much connected with the foundations. Well, that plan that they gave Bing to enunciate was a plan for closing off portions of the city. Bing said he wanted 9 to 11 urban villages across the city and that the other areas would be closed off and that people would be relocated, et cetera. Now, that rhetoric was, as a basketball player, you know, he knows how to rush the basket, but you can't really do that in politics because it doesn't sound very good. People start talking about the Trail of Tears and things like that when you talk about shutting down neighborhoods. So they softened the rhetoric of it a little bit. And to make a long story short, what we have now is the Detroit Future City Plan that has grown out of several iterations of the original Bing plan. Basically what that does, and I think your audience might be fascinated by this, is it assesses every neighborhood, every census tract in Detroit using something called market value analysis and some other tools. But what market value analysis basically does is it asks what is the health of the housing market in each census tract. And based on that analysis, then divides the city into, I guess you could say, triage zones. Some are called distressed housing markets, some are called steady housing markets, and some are called transitional. And one thing that is important to know is that we used to call neighborhoods that were poor housing markets, we used to call those the neighborhoods where poor people lived, right? And we thought that those would be the ones that would benefit from government support and other forms of support. But what it means now is something very different. It means that, like in No Child Left Behind, which said that we shouldn't reward failure, we should shut down schools that get the poor test scores. And we know that poor test scores basically reflect where the poor live. So we could shut down their schools was, you know, the basic bottom line of No Child Left Behind. And market value analysis puts that in, it redefines neighborhoods as housing markets, says that poor neighborhoods should not get public investment, that public investment should flow directly to the steady housing markets, which means the wealthy markets. And that's why we see bus service, which has always been a joke in Detroit, absolutely falling apart. The buses falling apart, non-operational, so many of them. Two-hour delays on common bus routes. Service curtailed greatly on Sundays. Not that, you know, like not everyone, not that anyone has anywhere to go on a Sunday or that people don't work on a Sunday. While we have a nice light rail line being built up and down the cultural corridor to help real estate values in that area, we have parks that are not mowed and that are basically becoming you know, wildlands with coyotes and pheasants where kids used to be able to play, while at the same time he is invested in making the parks along the river much more beautiful, again connected to the realty market. I'll stop there for now, but that, for me that has to be the frame, is the Detroit Future City framework, which has existed under other names, and the bankruptcy is maybe a point of focus, of getting everyone on the same page, because now we're at a point where Kevin Orr, the city's emergency manager, and Mayor Duggan and Governor Snyder are all on the same page with the philanthropy saying Detroit's future city is the way forward.
Well, Elena, you and Professor Petroni are talking essentially about race and racism as a central theme in what is happening to the schools in Detroit, as it happened in New Orleans. Could you talk about the importance and the centrality of race in this whole issue?
I absolutely will be glad to, and I want to invite listeners to Facebook me by my name, Elena Herrada, for further and deeper discussion, especially as we watch the Detroit Public Schools, as we undertake moving the emergency manager out of Detroit Public Schools. I'll spell my name for you. It's E-L-E-N-A-H-E-R-R-A-D-A. And I invite supporters to check us out. The Detroit Public School Board in Exile has no website. We have no newsletter. Parents only get a hold of us through sheer luck, or if they have the wherewithal to come to school board meetings. So we've basically been buried into obscurity, but we're still here. And I invite people to join us in this battle, because when we run the emergency manager out of Detroit Public School, it will be able to really encourage those other cities in Michigan that are under emergency managers, which are every black city in Michigan. in order to be able to be encouraged that we can do this, that we're able to do this, that things are done to us, but it doesn't mean that they have to stay that way. So I really want to encourage people to support Detroit in our efforts for self-determination once again. I want to mention some of the things that Tom talked about. He refers to Duggan as the mayor. I will never, ever say that Duggan is the mayor because I went to the recount every day. First of all, Detroit is a city that's 85 to 90% African-American. And Duggan is a white man who was not on the ballot because he did not live here. Let me also say that if Jesus Christ was running as a write-in, he would not be elected here because people would not go to the polls and write in anybody. It's just not something that would happen, particularly in a primary election. But in that amazing election 1 year ago, we had the highest voter turnout in the history of primaries, even though nobody saw anybody at the polls. We had the highest number of people go to the polls and write in Mike Duggan as the mayor. That followed the city council agreeing to a consent agreement that put us under the emergency manager. The paid city council voted 5-4 to basically strip Detroit of self-determination and allow the things that we're looking at now, because we would never have an emergency manager if it hadn't been for the consent agreement or the emergency manager law, which the people of Michigan repealed. So I want to really express to the listeners that we have a completely corrupt and rogue government, and it's been the Republicans and Democrats are complicit in the stripping away of black power in every single city in Michigan: Detroit, Benton Harbor, Highland Park, Flint, and Pontiac. All are under emergency managers. That means that none of the governing bodies in those cities have the right to a curriculum in the school, to be able to say what's going to happen to our own resources. We are taxed and we have no representation. And the kinds of policies that are being imposed on us are creating greater and greater poverty for black and brown people in every one of these cities in Michigan, which I have now come to refer to as the unaligned cities. So we are under emergency manager in every black city in the state of Michigan. Detroit would never elect a white mayor who was not on the ballot, much less probably most likely a person who has never had any history of doing anything at all for the city of Detroit. So I want to be really clear on that. We did not elect a white mayor, but there is a white mayor in Detroit. That person is central to the takeover of these schools and to the takeover of our city. So we must understand that there is a deep, deep, deep resentment that's going on in Detroit because of people who have long, deep roots in the city of Detroit having no representation, and people who just arrived having all kinds of privilege. So that's an important point to make. So when you think about Detroit being this place of great investment, you have to think about the profound disinvestment that's gone on here for the last 40 years.
And in reference to Katrina, you were credited by Dr. Petroni as also talking about this Katrina analogy. How did you, what is the significance of Katrina in Detroit?
Well, the Recovery District was the model for what was brought here as the Educational Achievement Authority, which is basically stripping away all public money from the public schools and creating a bogus district that allows private hands to be able to loot it. I also want to mention that the first year that I was on the board, which was 2010, Bing was still the mayor here. And Bing, I have to say, was brought in by the corporate forces to be able to bring us to where we are now, following the removal of our mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick. So I ran into Bing in the airport in New Orleans. I was there for a conference of bilingual educators, and Bing was there meeting with these Katrina people, with the Recovery District people. And it was clear that he had no idea. And there's no reason to speak ill of Bing, because he's absolutely hapless in all of this. He was brought in as the face to push all of this forward. he was so well liked by white people that he would not have been the mayor to be in place Kilpatrick was the perfect representation of what white people hated and would be made to be this corrupt, inept, arrogant, young black mayor that ends up with 28 years in prison over things that the Jones Day law firm does every day, all day. So we have a mayor, a young mayor who's in prison. We had six elections in two years, because the city council couldn't decide what to do about not having a mayor. So I have to give that background to let you know why 5 to 8% of the electorate goes to the polls, because we were completely abused with bogus elections during the time of the Kilpatrick drama. And then comes Bing, who won against, this is really bad, Mayor Bing, who had been a basketball player and a failed businessman. He had all of his businesses were in bankruptcy. Was elected with 8% of the vote against Kenneth Cockrell Jr., who was an incumbent who had been on the city council, who bore his father's name. His father had been an activist in the 70s and was a well-respected radical. But Ken Cockrell Jr. was the interim mayor after Kilpatrick got kicked out, and he was beat by Bing. So politics had just been just in the toilet here for about the last, I honestly have to say, because following Mayor Young, we had Archer, and I'll refer to these administrations historically because it doesn't make any sense to talk about today without giving the context for how we got to this. We had Coleman Young, which many people in Detroit equate with Toussaint and Detroit being Haiti. We had a mayor that was not afraid, that talked back to powerful people, that was beloved and was in office for 20 years. And if he wanted to run for another 20 years, he probably would have been elected. Beloved Coleman Young. Following him comes Dennis Archer, beloved by white people, who had been on the Supreme Court and got off the Supreme Court to run for Detroit mayor. That period of time of Coleman Young I would refer to as the blockade. We had an internal blockade against Detroit from the suburbs, and there was nothing coming to Detroit from white people. White people left, making it a black city. Then comes Archer, pretty much the giveaway. Now we have casinos. We got three casinos within a mile of each other immediately upon Archer being elected. Coleman Young wanted casinos too, but he wouldn't get them because he would have insisted on black ownership. So nothing new came to Detroit for industry when Coleman Young was the mayor because we were blockaded. Following that, Archer, everything comes in, but there's all these tax abatements. It's basically a giveaway. Following Archer is Kilpatrick. I'll refer to that period as the heist because so much had happened under Archer that now Kilpatrick is this young mayor who was basically, you know, I think he was 30 or 30 or 31 years old. He was hapless. He was attacked. He was easily vulnerable because he was just basically arrogant and clueless. I wouldn't say he's the biggest criminal we've ever seen here, but that's what you would get from the newspapers. Following Kilpatrick, then we get Cockrell. Following Cockrell, we get Bing. So we have had no leadership here in, 15 years? We've had no leadership in the city of Detroit in all of these years. We've had nobody that defended the people from the corporations. We've had nobody that defended us from these takeovers. So that's the period of the city. We had five city council members vote against ourselves to give away the city, to give away all of our assets, to bring us on to the point where pensions are being stolen from the people who earn them. So that's the historic context that we've been really beaten down, and yes, much of it has been by friendly fire. There are so many collaborators with the emergency manager, it would make your head spin, and that's also why we're in this condition, because we don't have people who should be on our side are not on our side because they're getting little deals from the emergency manager, or people are trying to get charter school deals because they're the most progressive educators and they have bought into the racist line that Detroit Public Schools is incapable of governing itself. So we have people like the Boggs Center for Education in bed with the emergency manager to be able to get a contract to get a school. People who should be with us are not with us because everybody's getting a little piece of the pie. So that it's important to also call out collaborators and betrayals, because this could not have happened if it was just an all-out attack on everyone here.
Dr. Pedroni, in a very real way, Elena Herrada is describing what theoreticians would call white supremacy. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that white supremacy absolutely underlies the dynamics we're seeing. As simple as the level of look at what is the rationale for imposing emergency management in the first place. It's basically a rationale that says the people here brought the situation on themselves in a city that's 82 to 80 or up to 90%, as Elena said, African-American. It says that the problem that brought all this about was a combination of essentially two things. One was the electoral choices of African-Americans, and so the solution in emergency management is to take away those electoral choices, to say, it was nice that some people, starting with the Civil Rights Act in the mid-60s, sometimes got a chance to vote, but we're past that now, and so we need to return to the era of benign white governance from people like Republican Governor Snyder and the majority white population, and mostly conservative population, I might add, of Michigan. If that isn't white supremacy, I don't know what is. But the second thing is to talk about Detroit is pathological because of its supposed pathological culture, which whenever something like that is paraded out is, of course, something that has deep racial resonances. When you have a city that is, it may be only 85% African-American, but in the white imaginary, it's 100% African-American. So the cleavages here between whites and blacks, and ostensibly between city and suburb, although it's a little bit more complicated than that, are really sharp. The racial rhetoric is aimed at Detroit is absolutely vindictive and ugly. I've personally never seen anything like it. So basically, the other thing I wanted to mention in relation to white supremacy is the real problem that those who might be able to discover wealth in Detroit have because of the way that Detroit is understood. So think about it this way. Many theorists, David Harvey and many others, have talked about the idea of accumulation through dispossession. And they've talked about an entity known as the urban growth machine, which is basically essentially the twin interests of real estate capital and financial capital. And those are exactly the folks who benefit tremendously from the race-based and government-subsidized, we always have to add, white flight from the city. That caused the sort of churn that always benefits real estate interests. You have people who are leaving houses in one area and then are relocating and purchasing and building in another area. So there's a lot of money there to be made. Part of building that success required labeling Detroit a certain way. So Detroit has emerged in the white public imaginary, a very potent white supremacist force, as the nightmare black city par excellence. You can't say Detroit in anywhere in the world without thinking African American, and that works very well for getting people to flee the city and not to invest in the city. But you've got a problem then when you realize that to make a lot of money out of the lands in Detroit, you've got to reverse that churn again. So here you've succeeded so much because you've labeled Detroit as this white nightmare of white dystopian city, and now you think about, well, how am I going to get white folks to go back there again and buy land when I was so successful at getting them to understand it through this white supremacist lens? So the rebranding of Detroit in ways that become palatable for reinvestment and moving here by whites is a very complicated task. And that's why I've talked in some of my research about the importance of school closures. Schools are a very important identity marker for people in any city, and that's certainly true as well in Detroit for its mostly African-American residents. People speak with pride about the schools that they went to, maybe particularly their high schools, that oftentimes the same school that their parents and their grandparents went to. They're a very important identity marker for, including for Detroit's African-American population. Well, one of the things that you have to do if you want to take an area that is is considered African-American space in the white imaginary and has all these black identity markers is you have to destroy those identity markers. So although Mayor Bing would always say back a few years ago that he didn't have a plan, that he was merely talking about this idea of closing down some areas of the city, at the same time we had the emergency school manager, Robert Bob, who was assuring reporters that as he was choosing schools, he was consulting with Mayor Bing about which areas of the city were the ones that the banks wanted Bing to close down. And he said he based his decision about the massive school closures that he made. And to really quickly back up something that Elena said, we have had, since emergency management, we've had over 100 schools close out of almost 300 schools have closed just in since 2009. And we had an announcement 2 weeks ago from our current emergency manager that 24 more schools would be closing, bringing us below 75 from a district that had almost 300. We've had well over 200 school closures since 2002, which is when students started fleeing Detroit public schools en masse under the first state takeover that lasted from 1999 until 2004. Again, you had Robert Bob, who was consulting with the mayor about which schools to close, which reflected which areas were to be shut down. And an important thing that we know happens when you close down schools is not only the smashing of black identity markers, but it also has a destructive impact on the whole neighborhood. You see a school closed first, and then you see housing around the school start to go downhill as well.
To what degree should the nation, especially major black cities, cities with large black and Latino populations, should be studying what's going on? They should have seen what went on in New Orleans, and they should be very, very much in tune with what is happening in Detroit. Because, I mean, is it paranoid to say that this is, in fact, a template?
I think people have been writing for quite some time about the way that America's cities are grounds for neoliberal experimentation. And you have some experiments obviously going on in New Orleans. You have other experiments that are taking place in Chicago. And Detroit is a very important laboratory as well. And one of the things I like to point out is how radical it is that African-American voting rights have been taken away, not just in Detroit, but in other black cities as well. And I can't help, I think it's an obvious point, but I'm going to make it anyway. I can't help thinking that if Detroit were a majority white city and voting rights were taken away, I think that I would hope that most of the American populace would be in uproar. Of course, I would hope that they'd be in uproar now, too. And I think what stops that uproar is, again, the way that whites understand African-Americans who are racially pathological white supremacist lens and want to see it as, oh, well, those people brought this on themselves. It's part of their culture. They don't value education, that whole thing.
Elena, what is the challenge to white people? Not the kind that you were talking about, but the kinds who say they are progressive and the kinds who understand that, a society ought to be moving in a different direction.
I gave up on white people. I don't know what the challenge is to white people. And it's not so much that I don't think that people have a conscience or that people are pathological as a group, but I do know, I used to hear this friend, of all people, a friend in New Orleans that used to say to everybody in these progressive groups, these radical groups from across the country that would meet, he would always say, if you ain't working with poor black people, you ain't doing shit. And I used to listen to it, and I didn't really get it until I became an elected member of the Detroit School Board. And it was only then that I really understood. I never knew what racism was before I became a member of the Detroit Elected School Board. I never understood the deep, deep-rooted contempt that white people have for black people until I was a member of the school board, and I could see that black lives, especially the most vulnerable and poor, mean nothing to white people. And I do think that white people in general may not really be consciously aware of that. But I know in the progressive groups that I've worked with against the emergency manager that I can't see how to get white people to see poor black children as human beings. I just can't see it. I feel like I'm behind a plexiglass screaming. And so how to do that, I don't know, because there was a project of desegregation in Detroit public schools that I lived through as a child. I saw the busing, I saw the court decisions, I saw schools become integrated for a minute, and then all the white people moved out of Detroit. And their children and grandchildren are just now returning. And they are not returning to live in harmony with the black people who remained here. They are not bringing their children into the schools that have been ravaged by disinvestment. They are returning and creating a project of removal. They are either not bringing children with them, or as some older couples have said, they raise their children so they're moving back. But this is not a place where white people are bringing their children to be in school with black people. And as a non-black, non-white person, as a Latina, I can say that as a very small percentage of the population of Detroit, Latinos are sort of not in this mix, but we are a preferred minority, as other minorities are. But there is absolute contempt for blackness. And I don't have anything to say to in answer to what it would take to get white people to believe that there's a right of equal education for black people. I don't know what to say to that.
What is the immediate fight ahead for school control by the people of the city of Detroit?
Here we go. This is really important. So under the arbitrary and bogus Public Act 436, which replaced the law that we repealed, Public Act 4 under the emergency manager, after 18 months, the governing body can vote out the emergency manager. The Detroit School Board is one of two elected bodies in the city of Detroit. There's the city council and there's the school board. They get paid, we don't get paid. And they are, they're just pitiful. They're in tandem with the emergency manager and the mayor, which are basically a two-headed hydro here. So the city council has already relinquished its power and has been pretty much giving a nod to everything the emergency manager wants to do, but the school board has not. And we have a narrow majority because we do have people on the school board that are not, I would say, not with us in terms of being out from under the emergency manager, but we have a narrow majority. September the 29th is the 18-month date, even by their laws, that this emergency manager should leave. We've been under EM for 67 months. On October the 1st, we go to court for a declaratory judgment. We don't expect any relief in court because under emergency manager, all these judges are afraid of the governor because there's only one person who makes all the decisions in the state. And anybody who opposes the governor is a target. So we have not found any relief in any court, even though the laws are clearly, clearly violated under the PA 436. The judges are just basically, they might as well be Walmart greeters. So they never rule in our favor. But on October the 2nd, we're asking for people to come out and help us to say goodbye to the emergency manager at the beautiful Fisher Building where he holds his offices. And we're going to basically occupy the Fisher Building beginning on October the 2nd. And that's the cultural center where the theater holds plays, and there's a lot of commerce in that area. So they may be in for a long winter. But we're asking for people in Detroit and people of goodwill to support us in helping us to really grasp what we can do and also to understand. This is the thing that vexes me the most as a school board member, as a resident of Detroit, as just a regular human being. The thing that vexes me the most is how do we get people to believe that we can do something as easily as people will believe that they cannot do anything? The thing is, how do we bring out our best selves to rise to basically corrupt leadership? How do we uproot immoral authority? And how do we find it within ourselves to have the courage to believe that we can do that and to act on that? That is the question of the day. And that's something that I think that everybody around the country is going to have to be thinking about for everything, for what's happening in Palestine, for what's happening everywhere. How do people mine our best selves out of ourselves to be able to get into the streets when the ballot box has failed us and when the courts have failed us? Every legal avenue of redress has given us no justice. Now what do we do?
Professor Pedroni, what do they do?
Well, I think that Elena has talked about some of the most important efforts we're engaging in right now. We're also going to the State Board of Education tomorrow for their monthly meeting, where we want to make it very clear from a number of parties. Maybe Elena will be there, I'll be there, Ms. Helen Moore will be there, many community members will be there to say, we want our schools back. Look at the record, not only the law says so, but look at the record of the destruction. We know that we know where most people, or certainly the superintendent of public instruction, understand, and they're closely allied with Governor Snyder. But we are sometimes successful at creating enough of embarrassment to them in the public eye that perhaps we can gain some ground. One of the things that I wanted to feel like I really need to point out, too, that will be happening toward the same organizing goal that Elena was speaking to is on September 29th at the school board meeting, the Detroit Board of Education school board meeting, a filmmaker from New York City, Kate Levy, will be screening her 30-minute documentary of the closure of one of our schools by our last emergency manager, Roy Roberts. And I want to talk about that for just a couple minutes because I think it's very emblematic of the meaninglessness of black life, especially young black life, to certainly to the emergency managers and to most people who are even aware of it. So really quickly, Oakman Elementary Orthopedic School was a school of just under 300 students that served a student body that was 40% special needs and 60% so-called regular curriculum. This was a school in a very poor neighborhood, but a neighborhood that had a little bit of, you know, houses were looking a little bit nicer, a little bit investment had come, and was kind of on a, you know, it was doing well, especially considering how everything else around the neighborhood seemed to be falling apart. Well, we were aghast when the last emergency manager announced that this school would be closed. And there were three claims that the emergency manager offered to the principal, ostensibly the parents, in a letter, that the school had lost 50% of its enrollment since 2009, that the school was only operating at 50% of its capacity in terms of students, and that the school had $900,000 worth of damage done to it. So we were able to very easily, and I think this just shows the blatant disregard and the callousness, we were very easily able to go on to the Detroit Public Schools website and show that, in fact, enrollment had not declined by 50% since 2009. Enrollment was actually above its 2009 level and had been above the 2009 level every single year, according to the DPS's own data on its own website. So we, you know, that one was pretty easy to knock out. We then looked at the question of the capacity of the building, which they claimed was now at only 50% because there were 288 students, and they said the building had a capacity of 446. Well, the first thing is that that is 65% of the capacity, but I guess emergency managers aren't very good at math when they don't choose to be. But then what we discovered was that the building had been rated as having only a capacity of 290 until quite recently it jumped up to 446. And here was the school at 288 currently, which would mean it was at 99.2% of capacity, not 50 or 65. Really long story short, we couldn't get any answer even after Freedom of Information Act requests from the emergency managers team about why they had upped the capacity from 290 to 446 for the school. So I talked to the principal off the record of the school that was closing, who told me that she didn't know either why they upped it. She said that the number 290 presumably came from legal statutes, both at the federal and state level, about how many special education students could be in a classroom. And in fact, she had the booklet that is used by the district to determine how many students fit into a school. And we used it at that moment to calculate that exactly 290 students were supposed to be in that building, just as the old capacity had been. And the only thing that we were able to discover as far as where they came up with the 446 capacity was by simply multiplying the number of classrooms in that building by the number of regular education bodies that the district said you could now stuff into a school. We got the number 450. So we were able to show that that one wasn't true either. The building was actually at 99.2% capacity according to the law. And really long story short, the building didn't have $900,000 worth of damage, but after we were able to show publicly that the other two claims about enrollment weren't true, we were also able to show, the emergency manager came back and said there wasn't just $900,000 worth of damage, there was $3 million worth of damage, including to the roof. We brought in a professional inspector as a volunteer, actually two of them. They looked at the building and said at most it needed $150,000 worth of damage. So really long story short, a beautiful, loving school and a wonderful building that had all kinds of accommodations built by the staff lovingly, including a wheelchair-accessible garden, greenhouse, and playground, was taken away for nothing, or maybe for clearing that particular neighborhood for some other use that other people intended it for. But so one of the things we want to do, and we're going to do
for today, I'm afraid. We've come to the end of the program. I want to thank you, Elena Herrada. I want to thank you, Professor Pedroni, for being with us today and being casting such incredible light on a subject that has not received enough of it. Thank you so much for bringing this to attention today. And we will be following up again with you very soon. Thanks so much for being with us.
We hope to hear from you after the October 2nd date.
I'm sorry, Elena?
The October 2nd date? That we're running the emergency manager out. We would love to come back and report.
Let's work toward that. That's a good goal.
All right.
Thanks so much. Stay tuned. Wake Up Call is next with Richard Martin. Reach me at leadstories@facebook.com and leadstories@gmail.com. Bye-bye.